Welcome to the second West Coast webinar of a three-part series on climate change, waste prevention, recovery, and disposal, organized by the Environmental Protection Agency Region 9 and 10 offices. We are happy to have you participating. This webinar will cover compost and landfill issues. Before I introduce today's speakers, let me turn the line over to Tommy Jean from Tetra Tech to go over some of the call logistics.
Thanks, Dina. Welcome to the call, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. This is a recorded session. During the session, slides will be moved for you and your lines will be muted. If you can't see the presentations or if you would just like to download them to have, I'll send an email out or a URL out so that you can click there and download the presentation yourself. If you have questions, the only way to ask them is to type them into the chat box. If you look at the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a chat box there. That's where you can type in technical questions you might have about this technology or any issues you're having. You may also ask questions about the content of the presentation. At the end of each presentation, we have 5 or 10 minutes set aside for questions, and we'll read them aloud over the phone, and the speakers will answer them live. At the very end of the webinar, we'll also have 5 or 10 more minutes set aside for additional questions, so if you think of something for an earlier speaker, please don't hesitate to type it in at any time. If we don't respond to one of your questions online today, we'll try to email you a response later. You might note that there's a raise your hand feature. Unfortunately, we can't respond to those, so please don't use the raise your hand feature. All you need to do is use the chat feature to talk to us. We also like to get some feedback from you on these climate change sessions. At the end of the webinar today, a pop-up window will display asking you about 4 different questions, how effective was this, the content, the technology. We'd love to get your quick responses. They'll probably only take you 1 or 2 minutes to answer them. In addition, we'll send you an email later with a more thorough survey so you can type in comments if you have additional ones. That does it for me. For technology, remember to use the chat feature on the right-hand side. And Dina, I'll hand it back over to you to introduce our speakers.
Thanks, Tommy Jean. Today we will have 4 great speakers. We're going to hear more about the greenhouse gas implications of landfills and composting. As I mentioned, this is the second in our series of 3 webinars. The first session provided an introduction to climate change and materials management and covered some background material for this session. If you were not able to join us for that session, the materials are available on our website for you to download at your convenience. Our first speaker today will be Stephanie Young. Stephanie Young is a waste management engineer for the Waste Compliance and Mitigation Program of the California Integrated Waste Management Board. She has 14 years of experience in the solid waste management field and is currently responsible for facilitating the Climate Action Team's Recycling and Waste Management Subgroup, managing projects under the California Integrated Waste Management Board's Climate Change Landfill Methane Capture Strategy, and providing technical engineering assistance to both internal programs and external agencies. She will provide us with an overview of the connection between climate change and landfills. Following Stephanie, we'll hear from Sally Brown and Brenton Smith. They will be covering the connection between compost, organics, and greenhouse gases. Sally Brown is a research associate professor at the University of Washington College of Forest Resources. She is a member of the National Academy of Science Standing Committee on Soil Science, is on the Chicago Climate Exchange Committee to develop a protocol for methane avoidance from landfill diversion, and has a monthly column in BioCycle on greenhouse gases. Brenda Smith is currently a division chief for the California Integrated Waste Management Board, in charge of the statewide technical and analytical resources division that works on projects related to organics, green building, conversion technologies, climate change, extended producer responsibility, tires, and special wastes. She has 24 years of experience in both the public and private sectors. Finally, we will hear from Gary List, who will cover zero waste activities and their connection to climate change. Gary List has over 35 years of experience in the solid waste and recycling field and was a founder and past president of the National Recycling Coalition, and was solid waste manager for the city of San Jose, California. He has documented zero waste businesses, developed zero waste business principles, helped the Salt Lake Olympics and the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg achieve zero waste, and helped organize Zero In on Zero Waste business conferences. All of these speakers' full bios are available on our website if you'd like to read more about their experience. We will pause and answer questions briefly after Stephanie Young's presentation, after Sally Brown and Brenda Smith's combined presentation, and after the presentation from Gary Liss. We will also have time for questions at the end of the session. We know this is a long webinar. We don't have any breaks planned, but we will be posting a full transcript and audio file of the webinar, including the question and answer sessions, to our website. So if you need to step away for a few minutes, you can catch up on any content you miss. Thank you very much for participating. Let's get started.
Stephanie, the floor is yours, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Dana. Let me see. I've got control. So I'm just letting the disclaimer sit up there for a little bit. And then shall move on to the start of my presentation. So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the webinar. Today, I've been asked to talk about landfills and how they affect climate change, primarily the emissions from landfill gas, and most importantly, its methane component. So understanding emissions from landfills is an important element to understanding the relative benefits of certain waste recovery and diversion activities, such as composting, where methane avoidance can be a significant benefit. So on this slide, this is what I'd like to kind of go over today. I will first discuss some basics of the science behind landfill emissions, talk a little bit about how these emissions can be controlled, and end with examples of California's efforts related to landfill emissions. So just to warn you, I will be speaking more from a technical point of view, because my primary duties here at the Waste Board is to provide technical engineering assistance to the cleanup branch. So my experience in general has been a field lead or a project manager that coordinates, organizes, and executes large-scale engineering projects at landfills from concept stage through permitting, budgeting, contracting, construction, startup, and ongoing maintenance. So just to give you an idea of my point of view, I'm just one of those people that actually gets things done in the field. So let's begin and talk a little bit about landfills. So we're on slide number 4 right now. So why are landfills being targeted? Well, landfills produce methane, a very potent greenhouse gas. So according to California Energy Commission's 2005 consultants report titled Research Roadmap for the Greenhouse Gas Inventory Methods, landfills are the largest source of anthropogenic methane emissions in California. In EPA's 2008 report titled Inventory of U.S. Greenhouse Gas Emissions in Sinks from 1990 through 2006, EPA stated that landfills accounted for approximately 23% of the total U.S. anthropogenic methane emissions in 2006, which is the second largest contribution of any methane source in the United States. The first would be enteric fermentation, just in case you're curious. However, more recently, the California Air Resources Board completed their emissions inventory where emissions from landfills were estimated at 5.62 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent in 2006 and 6.26 in 1990. So essentially, the landfill industry has met their 1990 goals today. So why is methane a potent greenhouse gas? Methane absorbs terrestrial, meaning that's coming from the Earth, infrared radiation, otherwise known as heat, that would otherwise escape to space. In addition to being able to trap heat, it has a global warming potential 21 times that of carbon dioxide, meaning it is 21 times more powerful at warming the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. However, it has a chemical lifetime in the atmosphere of about 12 years, which is relatively short, thereby making it a great candidate for mitigation efforts over the near term. So just to mention, though, that methane is not only a potent greenhouse gas, it also has several potential threats to public health and environment. It is potentially explosive in volume ranges of 5 to 15% methane in air. It is an asphyxiant in confined spaces, which means it displaces the air we breathe. And it's odorous, toxic, and contains ozone precursor trace gases, otherwise known as volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. So moving on to the next slide. How does a landfill produce its methane? Well, it's actually a very complex anaerobic biological process. So after being placed in a landfill, the biogenic waste, such as the paper, food scraps, and yard trimmings, is initially digested by aerobic bacteria. After the oxygen has been depleted, the remaining waste is available for consumption by anaerobic bacteria, which can break down the organic matter into substances such as cellulose, amino acids, and sugars. These substances are further broken down through fermentation into gases and short-chain organic compounds that form the substrates for the growth of methanogenic bacteria. Methane-producing anaerobic bacteria convert these fermentation products into stabilized organic materials and landfill gas consisting of approximately 50% carbon dioxide and 50% methane by volume and some other little stuff such as the volatile organic compounds and mercaptans. How well these methanogens do depends on how much waste is there, what types of waste, preferably organic decomposable types, how much moisture exists, the climate, which kind of relates back to the moisture and barometric pressures, and how old the waste is. So all these factors help determine how much and how long this process of making methane will occur. Significant methane production typically begins 1 or 2 years after waste disposal in a landfill and may last from 10 to 60 years, sometimes longer, depending on where this landfill is. Next slide. Went too far. Okay, it's taking... Okay. Okay, great. So, this graph is in practically every textbook or guidance document that talks about landfills and landfill generation. So I thought I'd put it up here and share it with you today. So basically, it shows how the composition of landfill gas changes over time with how the cellulose and free fatty acid volumes are consumed over time. The time scale is not linear and is different for every site depending on the conditions mentioned in my previous slide. So just to go over the phases a little bit, you'll see over the top, see if I could get a pointer here. Oh, there we go. So these are the phases, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, over landfill gas composition by volume, cellulose fatty acids, over time. So phase 1 is when the biological decomposition occurs under aerobic conditions. The primary byproduct of this is carbon dioxide. And phase 2 is when all the oxygen present is completely consumed and the anaerobic bacteria begin to grow. Phase 3 is the stage when acids, such as acetic, lactic, and formic acids in alcohols, start to develop as they are converted by the anaerobic bacteria. In this stage, the pH starts to drop due to all the acids, and carbon dioxide and hydrogen are the primary byproducts. And phase 4 is when a second group of microorganisms, the methanogens, convert this acetic acid and hydrogen gas to methane and carbon dioxide. This creates a more pH-neutral environment for the methanogenic bacteria to establish themselves. Methane and carbon dioxide are the primary byproducts in this stage. And then lastly, phase 5 is when, after most of the readily available biodegradable organic material has been converted to methane and carbon dioxide, landfill gas production begins to slow down and is further retarded if not enough moisture is present. I'll move on to the next slide, which should be slide 7. So what happens to all the methane that is produced? So this slide kind of shows the different methane pathways. So it is either emitted into the atmosphere. Let's see if I could get the pointer out here. Emitted into the atmosphere, it is oxidized in the soil zone, or it could be recovered and flared, which is burned off, or converted into electricity, landfill gas to energy. So not shown here because studies have shown it to be rather insignificant is methane that laterally migrates from the waste mass or methane that is stored in the waste mass. And this is not to be confused with carbon storage of material in landfill. This is actually the methane that kind of is retained in the waste mass during this process. And carbon storage would be a 30-minute topic on its own, which I do not plan to cover today. So for climate change efforts, emissions is of most concern. Methane not captured, which is not as naturally oxidized in the subsurface or removed by controls, is released to the atmosphere as fugitive emissions. The current methods for calculating methane and other pollutant emissions from landfills have been subject to intense scrutiny. The major concern is that the estimate makes assumptions, which do not take into account all relevant factors that can have an influence on actual emissions. Methane emissions typically estimated with high degree of uncertainty by models and by direct measurement, which I will talk more about in greater detail later. Also to note that in California, there's an increasing share of organic waste stream that is diverted from landfills and is composted. These composting facilities are managed to maximize aeration and reduce methane production, which Brenda and Sally will talk more about later. Now we'll move on to the more technical part of the presentation. So how are these methane pathways determined? Since emissions are what we are concerned with, I'll work my way backwards, beginning with the methane recovered to what's oxidized and generated and then what's fully emitted. So I'll start with how we can determine how much methane is actually recovered from a landfill. There are two ways, the direct measurement and indirect calculations. So the direct measurements, this is where methane is recovered by an active system of vertical wells or horizontal collectors. The recovery is directly quantified by mass flow measurements. So methane recovered is directly calculated from measured flow rates and the methane concentration, which are typically taken at the main header line from the entire system to the actual collection and control device, which could be the flare or the energy recovery system. So assuming that the methane concentration is constant between measurements, you can multiply the two and actually get a direct measurement of what is actually being recovered. But indirectly, say that your landfill doesn't have a landfill gas collection system, then another method of calculating potential recovery is to use a landfill gas generation estimation model, such as the Environmental Protection Agency's Landfill Gas Emissions Model, also known as LANGEM, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC's First Order Decay Model, or you can hire a consultant that has their proprietary models, which for the most part, in my experience, has been the same models, the IPCC or the LANGEM, but they use site-specific data to calibrate them. Then, using an assumed collection efficiency, meaning the percent of which at what a comprehensive system is capable of capturing, the amount recovered is simply the multiplication of the collection efficiency and the model's estimated generation rate in standard cubic feet per minute. This method is typically used when designing a system, especially to size a blower, vacuum, or control device systems. Next is methane oxidation, and we should be on slide 9 right now for those of you not following on the webinar cast. So microbial methane oxidation is carried out by methanotrophic bacteria, or methanotrophs, which is not to be confused with the methanogens that create methane, as discussed earlier. These methanotrophs possess a specific enzyme which allows them to oxidize methane to methanol, which is then further degraded to carbon dioxide. So previous field efforts have shown that a significant portion of the methane present in the cover is oxidized by indigenous methanotrophs and can result between 10 to 100%. And in some cases, it was shown that the methanotrophs even consume atmospheric methane, resulting in a negative flux, which means that there's some, you know, atmospheric methane that's in the atmosphere, and some methanotrophs were not given enough methane from the landfill cell will actually suck in methane from the atmosphere and treat it. That's why there's a negative flux. So what affects this is the effectiveness of the cover and its thickness, physical properties, moisture content, and temperature. The oxidation rate also relates to the amount of methane being released to the landfill surface. So if there's no methane, there's no methanotrophs. So the two techniques are, the direct technique is that has been used in many studies to measure oxidation is called the stable carbon isotope technique. Since there is a preferential oxidation of the elemental carbon-12, over the elemental carbon-13 in methane by the methanotroph, it is possible to determine the oxidized fraction by quantifying the change in carbon-13 of methane between the anaerobic zone and the surface. So anaerobic zone gas can be collected from recovery headers and wells or probes that are directly inserted into the waste mass, while gas reflecting methane oxidation was collected either in a static flux chamber or through upwind or downwind air sampling along selected transects. So I've included a link to a paper by Borgeson, Shanton, and Svensson regarding this technique if you'd like to learn more. So the indirectly, it has been well established that landfill cover soils provide some measure of oxidation of fugitive methane as it travels through the landfill surface, and methanotrophic microorganisms are present in most soils. So I put together this slide, which kind of shows all the different studies that are out there and breaks down what the results were, their methane oxidation and maximum rate, and the fraction of the methane that they showed to have been oxidized by these different cover soils or biofilters. And this actual table was done by our consultant as part of an exercise for a guidance document on reducing landfill methane that I will talk more about later. So I thought it would be helpful for you to have this. Let's move on to the next slide. So let's move on to methane generated. There are many direct methods for measurement methods for this part. Actually, I only know of one company that has developed a direct measurement natural gas estimation method, and that company is Hydrogeochem Incorporated. But there are probably a few others. Other pseudo-direct measurements have to do with the generation models and determining site-specific values for the input parameters. So I'll go into greater detail about those values in the indirect section. The barometric method consists of accurate measurement and analysis of the pressure response in the landfill to natural variations in barometric pressure. The method is based on gas flow principles and independent estimates of the gas permeability of the cover, refuse, and surrounding soil. I haven't seen this in action myself, but I've provided a link for more information if you'd like to learn more. So since there aren't many direct methods, the methane generation can be indirectly estimated using either actual landfill gas system recovery data and an assumed collection efficiency to calculate what is generated to kind of divide the two. However, the most widely used indirect method is to use the first order decay model. So the first order decay model is based on a first order reaction, where the amount of product is always proportional to the amount of reactive material. This means that the year in which the waste material was deposited in the landfill is irrelevant to the amount of methane generated each year. It is only the total mass of decomposing material currently in the site that matters, and also its age. The two most predominant first-order decay models are the landfill gas emissions model, otherwise known as the LANGEM, developed by EPA, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change model, which I'll shorten as IPCC. Links to more of this more information on the actual models are provided. So LANGEM can be used to estimate total landfill gas and methane generation, as well as emissions of carbon dioxide, non-methane organic compounds, and individual air pollutants from landfills. LANGEM primarily uses defaults for model inputs based on empirical data from the United States landfills, primarily the K value, which is the methane generation rate, and the L-naught value, which is the potential methane generation capacity. The methane generation rate, the K rate, determines the rate at which the methane is generated from the waste in the landfill. The higher the value of the K, the faster the methane generation rate increases, and it decays over time. So it generates really fast, and then it goes out. So you get most of the generation out in the first few years. The value of K is primarily a function of four factors: the moisture content of the waste mass, the availability of the nutrients of microorganisms that break down the waste to form methane and carbon dioxide, the pH of the waste mass, and the temperature of the waste mass. Now, the potential methane generation capacity, or the L-naught value, depends only on the type and composition of waste placed in the landfill. The higher the cellulose content of the waste, which is the degradable part, the higher the value of L-naught. Field test data can also be used in place of the model defaults when available, but can be cost-intensive to perform. The IPCC model further breaks down the K and L-naught values by allowing inputs of actual waste composition and landfill conditions. So using your inputs, the model then calculates the K and LNOT values that are appropriate for the landfill that are used in this model. But please note that there are many uncertainties associated with this first order decay model. A particular difficulty for the methodology is that the type of waste deposited in the landfill is required, and more specifically, the type of degradable organic material, for example, yard clippings, tree pruning, food, are required. These data are required ideally on a yearly basis and are not readily available. And in California, we do have waste characterization studies that have California-specific values, but is to be probably better used for planning purposes, not necessarily measurements. So let's move on to methane emitted, which would be slide 12. Finally, I'll talk a bit on methane emissions from landfills. Methane emissions are a function of several factors, including the total amount of municipal solid waste in landfills, broken down annually, the characteristics of landfills receiving waste, such as the composition of waste in place, size, climate, liner and cover systems, and the amount of methane that is recovered and either flared or used for energy purposes, and the amount of methane oxidized in landfills and in cover soils instead of being released into the atmosphere. Next slide. So there are many different techniques of direct measurement of landfill emissions. As seen in the following slides, however, there are many pros and cons, with the biggest controversy revolving around determining the actual flux of methane from the area of a landfill and mass per square meter per day. I've provided the table for you, but will not go into much detail on each one. I will, however, talk about the two that are currently being researched, the flux chamber method and the optical remote sensing or radio plume mapping. And I've also on this slide provided where I got the tables from, just in case you'd like to research it more. So the first table, move on. This is the first part of the table that kind of describes the methods, gives a description, has advantages and disadvantages, and overall opinion. This is a document that California Energy Commission put together when determining their research goals for climate change back in, I believe it was 2005, 2008. So this is the first one. And this is the second part. Here it is, 2005. So the methane emitted part, the two methods of direct emissions monitoring is the flux chambers and the optical remote sensing radio plume mapping. And for those of you that like to research a little bit more about it, I've provided some more information. The first one's an EPA user's guide on emissions isolation flux chamber. And the second one is actually a PowerPoint presentation done by Ms. Susan Thornlow of the EPA on her optical remote sensing and radio plume mapping. There you go. So this slide kind of shows photos of a landfill in California where both techniques were being used. On the left is the flux chamber, and on the right is kind of like a far-off view of the radio plume mapping and optical remote sensing. So the flux chambers are used to determine levels of subject compounds emitted from land or liquid surfaces. The flux chamber is set up to enclose a known surface area. Air is introduced to the chamber to mix with the emissions and transport them to a collection device. The chamber should be designed to create the best mixing and sampling conditions without altering the emissions of gases at the surface. The samples collected are used to determine the actual flux of pollutants at the surface in micrograms per square meter per minute. But note, due to the configuration and size of the flux chamber, it would be difficult to install it around well penetrations. So on the left-hand side here, we have the flux chamber being installed on the surface, and they have to ensure that there's a tight seal between the cover soil and the actual flux chamber itself. And on the top one is the cover, which has a mixing component and a sampling component. So as you can see, it's kind of hard to put it up against a well penetration, which would be on this upper right-hand side. So in this situation, this particular study readily placed flux chambers out to get an idea of what that what the flux might be from this certain penetration. Now, the optical remote sensing and radio for mapping was developed at the University of Washington, and in 1999, researchers from the U.S. EPA Air Pollution Prevention and Control Division of the National Risk Management Research Laboratory at Arcadis began work investigating and characterizing emissions from area sources using this method. The radio plume mapping method uses a simple configuration of non-overlapping radial beam geometry to map the concentration distributions in the plane. So basically what happens is these two little devices, one is a vertical radio plume mapping device and the other one is a horizontal one. So there's a set of deflectors that's set up horizontally along the surface, and also some deflectors that are actually set up on the scissor. And they send the laser beams to these deflectors and get concentration data across the plane, both horizontally and vertically. They actually have software. So using the optimization algorithms in the software, the path integrates concentration data is converted into spatially distributed concentration maps, showing the locations of emissions and hot spots. And the vertical radio plume mapping configuration consists of several optical beam paths deployed downwind from an area source. So incorporating the wind information, the flux of the plane can be directly calculated, leading to a direct measurement-based estimation of an emission rate from the upwind area source. But I want to note that the study is currently underway, so as such, results from the two, how the two compare are not yet released. I thought this was a pretty nice schematic of a flux chamber. So I want to note that measuring methane emissions directly is very difficult. One problem is that a landfill surface emissions are extremely heterogeneous spatially. According to some studies, the heterogeneity of landfill emissions is best integrated by large-scale direct measurement techniques, such as plume measurements, where entire surface area can be considered. And according to others, this problem can be overcome by using multiple measurements using a simpler technique, such as the chamber method. Some studies have found good agreement, about less than 10% difference, between chamber and plume shapes and measurements, and argue that if properly done, both methods are reliable. Other researchers argue that static chambers can hardly be trusted for making more than small-scale estimates of landfill gas emissions because it kind of takes in a small surface area, the chamber itself anyway. But most researchers, even those who found agreement between chamber readings, recommend tracer and plume methods whenever possible because of their simplicity. So Borgeson, in a communication in 2004, notes that the failure to account for the heterogeneity of emissions or the failure to cover the hot spots of emissions resulted in a factor of 4 difference between chamber and tracer methods. And large sampling projects are extremely laborious because of the number of samples needed and the resulting large amount of data, which results in chambers not being widely accepted for large-scale flux measurements. So it's clear that if a chamber method that to be used, it is best that researchers utilize methods that account and correct for any distortions that this method may create as a result of spatial heterogeneity. So on to slide 19, we're continuing with methane emissions. So since there's quite a bit of uncertainty when trying to directly determine actual area emissions from an entire landfill surface, many have relied upon the old indirect method of using the first order decay model to estimate the amount of methane generated. From that, if a landfill does not have a system in place, the amount emitted would simply be the amount generated minus what is oxidized. But if a landfill has a comprehensive gas collection system, EPA identifies a 75% as a default collection efficiency to use, which I know gives many people heartburn. The amount emitted would then be the amount generated minus the amount collected or controlled minus the amount oxidized. So I wanted to discuss the 75% collection efficiency a little bit further on this slide. So landfill gas collection efficiency is the amount of landfill gas that is collected in the system compared to the amount generated. As mentioned, there's quite a bit of controversy around the 75% collection efficiency value. A study was done by the Los Angeles County Sanitation District where they found their systems to be near 100% efficient in collecting the gas. and other studies show between 85% to 99%, especially the systems that are compliant with the federal air quality regulations, specifically the New Source Performance Standard, or Emissions Guidelines Rule, which is also known as the NSPSEG, may show collection efficiencies higher than 75%, where landfills must meet stringent surface emission performance standards. But on the other hand, lower collection efficiencies are for those landfills that are not regulated under federal rule, but do have systems in place for other reasons, such as water quality degradation or gas migration control. However, with any method, estimating methane emissions is problematic due to the high spatial variability of emissions, so no one surface is alike, and heterogeneity of MSW, municipal solid waste, and variations in rainfall and climate. So until consensus or near consensus could be obtained on how the collection efficiency can be determined or tested in a site-specific manner, it appears as though we're stuck with a 75% default. Next slide, which is slide 20. So how can we control what emissions do escape from the landfill? First of all, one could keep the degradable stuff out of it in the first place, such as green and food material, shrubs and bushes, trees, anything else organic. The green and food material can be composted, the paper could be recycled, and other remainder composite organics anaerobically digested, which is actually an emerging technology. But some landfills even segregate their organic waste into dedicated landfill cells so they can control the decomposition either aerobically or anaerobically with highly designed capture systems. The rest are considered engineering and operational controls, such as installing recovery systems before regulations require, changing the landfill gas system design, operating and maintaining their existing systems differently, increasing monitoring to be able to detect leaks better, or changing the way they build their landfills in the first place, such as a bioreactor. An owner or operator may also elect to install a bio cover to oxidize methane if conditions allow. A more comprehensive discussion of each of these items is provided in the California Integrated Waste Management Board's publication 200-08-001. Don't bother writing that down. It's in another slide. I've provided that. And it's titled Technologies and Management Practices for Reducing Greenhouse Gases from Landfills. And it may be downloaded from our website. Okay. So what are some of the things California is doing? Well, these are just a few examples of the projects currently underway, and by no means is this an exhaustive list. So we're on slide 21 right now. So the Climate Action Team, which was created by the Environmental Protection Agency in response to Governor Schwarzenegger's Executive Order S-3-05, identified a strategy for increasing landfill methane capture to reduce methane emissions by 2020. The landfill methane capture strategy includes three core components. The first is to install new methane control systems in landfills currently without control systems. Second is to maximize landfill methane capture efficiencies by optimizing landfill design operation closure, post-closure practices. And the third is to increase recovery of landfill gas for use as biomass renewable energy source to replace energy from non-renewable fossil fuel sources. So under the first one, the California Air Resources Board is currently developing a control measure that will reduce landfill methane emissions by requiring control systems where systems not currently required and performance standards for maximum capture. They hope to achieve 1 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent of emissions reductions from this measure alone. Under the second one, there's several activities going on. The first is the Waste Board retained SES engineers to develop the guidance document to help landfill operators and regulators evaluate potential actions to achieve additional greenhouse gas emission reductions from landfills beyond what are already currently occurring with existing landfill practices. And on the slide is the link that I promised to that particular guidance document. The second one is the Waste Board also has a project underway to research the long-term performance and maintenance of green material to oxidize methane from the landfill sources. This is anticipated to have widespread use over those smaller landfills that may not be able to meet the performance standards set by ARB, and this operation would require fresh green material, a chipper, and equipment to place over the surface. So, pretty simple. And the study is expected to be completed in 2010. And the last one, there's a lot of ongoing research on how to get at this emissions portion of the equation. The California Energy Commission is funding a project to create a scientifically sound and practical detailed landfill methane emissions model and inventory methodology to account for variation across landfill site-specific characteristics, climate, and oxidation cover soils. They plan to collect 2 years of field data at landfills in different climate regions throughout California, using flux chambers to obtain emission factors and radial plume mapping at one landfill to provide additional field validation. Waste Management is also doing their own research on radial plume mapping, which they plan to share the information with the California Energy Commission's project team. And then the Los Angeles County Sanitation District has already written a paper on how they recommend their landfill owner determine their collection efficiency. 5 minutes, okay. And lastly, but no small effort, is the last one. So recovering landfill gas to produce energy is getting increasingly hard in California due to the stringent air regulations. So projects, both demonstration and research, are focused on not only demonstrating new technologies, such as liquefied natural gas, but working to find answers to existing technologies to comply with regulations, such as what the California Energy Commission's Public Interest Energy Research Program is trying to do. So the California Public Utilities Commission, or CPUC, is also trying to even go beyond that by extending the reach of the Assembly Bill 1959, which currently only provides funding for renewable technologies at water and wastewater treatment facilities. They plan to extend their funding to all types of facilities that produce renewable energy. And not on this slide, but I would like to add a little bit about how landfills are being handled on the carbon trading market. The California Climate Action Registry developed the Landfill Project Reporting Protocol, which was accepted by the board in November 2007. An eligible project is the installation of a landfill gas control system for capturing and combusting methane gas that meets all performance criteria and exceeds all regulatory requirements, including local, state, and federal, and also commences operation on or after January 1st, 2001. But not many landfills, if any, will be able to meet the requirements of CCARS protocol due to the pending Air Resources Board regulations and the stricter rules that apply to all regulatory agencies, not just the federal, unlike the Chicago Climate Exchange. And under the Chicago Climate Exchange, entities and individuals in the waste management sector can participate by registering their offsets, which are the emission credits earned by eligible offset projects that sequester, destroy, or displace greenhouse gas emissions. The eligible landfills are those not required to collect methane by law for the NSPS, and methane offset projects placed into service on or after January 1st, 1999 may qualify. So that actually concludes my presentation. I appreciate you listening, and we'll try to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. We did have a few questions come in, and I want to let people know that they can go ahead and keep on typing in questions, but let me give you a few right now. You were talking about methane capture. Has there been any data on methane capture for alternative daily cover produced from yard debris?
Not that I know of. Let's see. So that's actually a study looking at ABC on top of, I'm trying to think that might be difficult because ADC is put on daily and then the next day someone comes in and they put a new layer of trash and then another ADC. So in order to study that on a daily basis might be difficult, but I don't know of any actual studies that target ADC. I can look into that further.
Okay, that would be great. A couple more questions. You were talking about direct measurement techniques. Is there any information on if measurements differ from each method, or are they fairly similar?
Depends on which direct measurement. So let's see, because like, for the methane emissions, there's the flux chamber and there's the optical plume mapping, and those are the ones that are actually being studied more now than all the others in the CEC document. And some studies have shown agreement, and some studies have shown, you know, four times different. And right now, this is what the California Energy Commission is doing with their study, and Waste Management is actually doing. So that those studies are actually underway, and those comparisons are not yet available. But there are some studies already out there that do try to compare the two. And
okay.
They vary from being close to very far apart.
All right. Let's see. So we also have a couple questions about the multiplier for methane. So this, I think specifically, if you have your slides in front of you on number four, you were saying the chemical lifetime time in the atmosphere is 12 years. So someone is referring to the Stop Crashing the Planet report, and it suggests using a 20-year multiplier for methane, resulting in 72 times CO2 equivalents, not the 21 times CO2 equivalents. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, I'm not too familiar with that report. I've seen in various other reports that the chemical lifetime is between 10 and 12 years. I haven't seen a higher one. That's why I used 12 years. So I'm sorry, I won't be able to really give you a nice answer on that one.
Okay.
Yeah. I pulled these out of different documents myself.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And unless we have time for just a couple more, are flaring systems able to collect and capture more methane than landfill gas to energy recovery systems?
Most of the time they use in conjunction. So they both use the same collection system, which is the series of wells or horizontal collectors that are actually inside the waste itself. So they all use the same kind of components of it. And the energy recovery or the flare is just the control device. So a landfill operator owner can choose to use one or the other, but most of them that have an energy recovery component do have a backup flare, because sometimes the landfill generates more methane or more landfill gas than an energy recovery device can handle. So they have both. So I don't know if one does better than the other, because there's the flare can actually destroy, if you mean like the destruction of methane, can destroy over 99% of the methane in a flare because of the high temperature. And the energy recovery device can destroy, it depends, there's different kind of engines, and some can destroy 90%, some can destroy upwards of 95%. But then if you think about the big picture, it's an energy recovery device, so it's actually avoiding, you know, fossil fuel emissions by, you know, converting this to energy. So it may actually emit a little bit more, but it's also doing a great climate change benefit by avoiding emissions elsewhere. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, great. A couple more here. I know we're throwing a lot of questions at you. Does the US EPA or the California Integrated Waste Management Board recognize biocover as reducing fugitive methane from landfills? And if so, does the landfill have to measure how much is oxidized, or is there like a default value given?
You know, that's what we're trying to get out, because the table I showed shows many, many studies out there that show that if you do certain things, you will get this amount of oxidation, but it hasn't been applied. So that's why the Waste Board is actually funding a study to actually look at that and come up with actual applied algorithms or models that an owner-operator can use by plugging in certain parameters to get an actual oxidation rate from, depending on the material that you use, the climate that you're in, what landfill situation you have, like what cover materials you already have in place, will be able to get at that. But as for defaults right now, I know that EPA uses a default of 10% to be conservative, although their studies have shown between 10 and 50%, and more recently studies have shown greater than 50% even at that. So, but as for an actual model that could be applied and, you know, to show that you're actually getting these oxidized numbers backed up with data, like how you take that data in order to put it into the model to get defensible results. That's what the Waste Board is working on right now.
Okay, great. Maybe we have time for just one more. So can you, are there any examples of co-location to use methane for energy production for other renewable energy production like biodiesel?
There are landfills, there is a landfill out there that is attempting to convert their landfill gas to liquefied natural gas, which is a vehicle fuel, and the Waste Board has actually awarded grant projects to Gas Technology Inc., which is planning to do a project in conjunction with Waste Management, and Lindy BOC at their Altamont landfill to convert landfill gas to liquefied natural gas. And the Altamont landfill actually has, in addition to them attempting to use LNG, they have a flare, and they actually have energy recovery on site. It's just that they're producing so much more that they want to be able to use that landfill gas for some other benefit rather than flaring it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all the time for questions right now, so we can move on to the next presentation. But keep sending in your questions, and we'll see if we can answer more at the end. So our next presenter is Sally Brown. And Sally, when you're ready, the floor is yours.
I mean, I can talk and get people asleep very quickly. and I'm going to split this with Brenda, and hopefully there'll be a very clear, very organized transition, and everybody will understand why we switch what we do, and then we switch back. So the title is Climate Change or Organics, Compost Issues, and what I've done with this presentation is try and go over the whole process that both Brenda and I have been a part of, trying to develop a methane avoidance protocol for the Chicago Climate Exchange focused on composting, diverting material from landfills, getting methane avoidance credits, and then associated potential benefits or credit with composting. And so... do I forward or do you guys forward? I don't remember.
You forward unless you would like some help.
No, I just press the forward and nothing is happening. So if somebody could forward to number 25, that would be great.
No problem. Here we go.
Okay. I don't mean to be so challenged.
Me some wrenching. There we go.
Okay. I'm still not forwarding here, but I...
So I have you on slide number 25, so just let me know when you're ready to keep moving.
I'm almost there. Come on, computer. Yes, okay, here we go. So here's the logical breakdown of the presentation. So what do you do? What happens with organics? And we're looking at what happens under anaerobic conditions, and I'm going to be providing a much less sophisticated version of an understanding of what happens in a landfill than we just heard, and my apologies for that. But so an uncontrolled decomposition of organics in landfills versus then we transition to Brenda when you have a controlled anaerobic digestion, which is what happens when you specifically dedicate a digester to decompose material without the presence of oxygen. From there we go to, okay, what happens then if we introduce oxygen into the system, take the material out of the landfill, put it in an aerobic pile like a compost pile. And so what happens to organics as they decompose in a compost system? And finally, what happens when you then take that compost and put it into a soil system? So looking at degradation and factors, benefits, associated byproducts of degradation in a range of environments. So if we go to the next one, number 26. And it's coming a little faster this time. By the way, the 21 time factor for methane is based on a 100-year time frame. So if you were to shorten it to a 20-year time frame, which a lot of people have suggested because methane only persists in the atmosphere for 9 to 12 years, then you would get a CO2 equivalent factor of 72, I believe. And that's where that comes from. And a lot of people, because there's some urgency about reducing CO2 in the atmosphere as quickly as possible, a lot of people have targeted methane because it only persists in the atmosphere for a very short time. And if you look at its global warming potential on a shorter time frame, it's much more potent on a shorter time frame than over the 100-year time frame. So that's a way to transition to that. Anyway, next slide is what life is like in a sanitary landfill. And here, what I want to describe here is something that was told recently in a meeting by Gene Bogner. Gene Bogner is the first author of the IPCC chapter on waste. She's a consultant out of Chicago that knows an awful lot more than I do about landfills. And there's a discussion in the IPCC documentation on landfills about climate temperature effects on rate of degradation of materials in a landfill. But IPCC is writing stuff up for the world as a whole. And the world as a whole does not have sanitary landfills like we generally do in the U.S. and many other developed countries. So what happens in a sanitary landfill versus what happens in an open dump in Malawi are two different things. And if you look in a sanitary landfill, what some of the data suggests is, to a certain extent, the landfill makes its own climate. Here's a graph from a study that was done in a sanitary landfill in France. There's another study out looking at landfills in Germany, and basically what you see is when you put the material into a sanitary cell, compact the material, and put a cover over the material, it starts heating up, and it'll stay pretty warm for an extended period of time. And so in the landfill here, at least, it's always t-shirt weather. I don't think anybody wants to live in a landfill, but if you choose to do so, don't pack your sweater. Here the temperature is in centigrade, and what you can see is that within 20 days after depositing waste into an active cell in a landfill, temperature goes up to about 40 degrees C, stays generally between 35 and 40 degrees C for the first 160 days that material is in the landfill. This is during a period when it's not springtime in Paris. The ambient temperature outside of the landfill in the beginning is under 10 C, and only after about 100 days does it get over about 20 degrees C. So it's much warmer in the landfill than it is outside summertime in the landfill. And then if you go to the next slide, which is number 27, and this is working much better, and I really appreciate your willingness to do this. So it's hot in there. Not only is it hot in there, it's hard to breathe. How quickly does oxygen get depleted? This is another graph from the same study, and you can see a precipitous drop in oxygen concentrations. Oxygen is the dark solid line with the little triangle there, and you see that the oxygen starts out okay at time zero, and before you get to 5 days, the oxygen is way down. It stays pretty low and then drops precipitously for what little left of a drop there is for it to drop to about zero at day 100. What you can also see is that methane starts to increase. Starting at day 20, you have some measurement of methane. When the cover goes on, it's in the middle of an increase, and that increase starts topping out at day 100 and stays pretty stable from there. So hard to breathe, hot in there, and how wet is it? Depending on where you are standing in that landfill, hopefully you haven't been overly compacted in the landfill, it's wet. It's not as wet as you would ideally like for anaerobic decomposition, but it's a moisture that varies. So if you're standing in the middle of those banana peels that are squished, it's very wet. By those crushed newspapers, you're a little drier. And you can see the moisture percentage in the landfill is 160 to 310 grams of water per kilogram of space. So it's certainly wetter than you're going to find in Tucson. I wish I could hear people groaning with these bad jokes, but if I could have the next slide. Okay. Okay, now, when you have these damp and wet conditions, these are great conditions for certain things to decompose and not very good conditions for other things to decompose. A lot of the studies that you see in the graph that we saw earlier on decomposition focus on cellulose and hemicellulose. These are compounds common in papers, and here you see a pizza box. This is our, where I live, this is our food waste, yard waste, joint collection bin, and so this is an actual slice of recycled materials going to compost in the Seattle area. The food waste, you're not going to find a high cellulose component. You're going to find more carbohydrates. You're going to find more sugars. All those potatoes and french fries that you didn't eat, fats, oils, and grease. You're going to find chemical compounds that are more readily degradable. You'll also find a very high moisture content and a high nutrient content in your food scraps. Paper will be too dry and too high in carbon to decompose very quickly on its own. So one of the things in the Chicago Climate Exchange group that we had was, first of all, what is it like inside the landfill, and then how do individual things behave within the landfill. Within the EPA, you see a degradation rate given for waste as a whole. Within the IPCC literature, you see different decay rate constants for different components of solid waste. What we focused on within the CCX subgroup was different decay rates and the material that's highly putrescible that's going to start breaking down right away, things like municipal biosolids, certain components of yard trimmings, yard waste, and food scraps. These were identified. Everybody agreed that these were all materials that would degrade very quickly on their own. Okay, so next. Okay, when you have anaerobic decomposition, we heard earlier about methane formation, but what can also happen when you have anaerobic decomposition, and here it's more when there's very, very limited oxygen, not completely absent of oxygen, but very limited oxygen. Also realize that conditions in landfills are often assumed to be pretty uniform, but you're going to be fairly heterogeneous. You're going to have hotter spots. These hot spots will migrate. Wetter spots, there'll be preferential areas of flow of moisture. You're going to have zones with some oxygen, zones with no oxygen. So don't think of a landfill as this monolithic sea of anaerobic conditions. Think of it as an area with some variation. Anyway, in the variation in the parts where you have organic nitrogen and you have little to no oxygen, you have the potential for that organic nitrogen to eventually denitrify, turn back to nitrogen gas, and if this reaction doesn't happen with 100% efficiency, you have the formation of nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide is something that you can form when you have a high nitrogen-containing material with a lot of carbon that's available for the microbes to eat. The deal with nitrous oxide is it's close to 300 times as potent as CO2 as a greenhouse gas. Okay, so these are the two things we're concerned about, both in a landfill as well as in a compost pile. And we can go to the next one. Okay, here, when you remove these materials, that are these highly putrescible materials that we talked about, and once we've set the stage for what life is like in a landfill, you have the potential to generate greenhouse gas credits by taking stuff that will make methane, and here we're only dealing with methane, even though nitrous oxide might be a factor. When you take these things out of the landfill, can you get credits for taking them out and having them decompose aerobically? And here on the CCX subcommittee, we used as a basis for determining how many credits you would get this very long and ugly looking equation, which is from a Clean Development Mechanism protocol. Clean Development Mechanism is the UN arm that works with the IPCC to develop protocols for specific project activities to give people credits. So even though this is a very long and ugly equation, what you can... Okay, Okay. What you can do is ignore a lot of these initials and the sigmas and even the E bases and focus on F. That first F is, which stands for the methane collection efficiency in the landfill. And then the second thing that we dealt with in the group was the K, the first order decay constant. How fast is stuff going to go away? So if we go to the next slide. Okay, this is my own understanding of gas collection efficiency at a landfill. And this is basically what a large number of people within the group had agreed on. EPA has their default of 75%, but that is over the entire life of a landfill. That's an average value over the life of a landfill. IPCC has 40-50% as their default value over the life. Now, what the actual efficiency is most likely zero before the gas collection systems are in place when waste is in place. And for the majority of landfills in the U.S., there is no gas collection system immediately in place as waste is being deposited into a cell. The EPA regs specify the 2 to 5 year period from when waste begins to be deposited and when gas collection has to be put into place. So what we agreed as a group was that before you have a gas collection system, there will be zero gas collection efficiency. Now, you may think that that sounds pretty obvious, but let me tell you, we had several hours of discussion on these conference calls about this, and this was a major consensus victory that we all agreed that if you're not collecting gas, you're not collecting it at zero efficiency. Next point is, when you're still accepting waste materials into the landfill, have a collection system in place. How efficient is it then? We had limited consensus as a group, but depending on who you talk to in the group, and there's a number of papers in the literature that suggest that efficiency while the landfill is still accepting materials, even if there is gas collection in place, collection efficiency is closer to the IPCC value than the EPA default. But there's also evidence that once you get a closed landfill, the gas collection efficiency comes to be just about on par with the methane generation rate. So rather than looking at it as a 75% or a single number over the lifetime, think of it in stages. And for us as a group in the CCX, we focus on that first stage, no collection, zero efficiency. Next slide. Okay. And this is our conclusion after months and months of discussion. I should say that the CCX subcommittee that was working on this had a lot of people from government. There were representatives from waste collection, the private industry, and also members of the offset committee on the CCX. So it was a pretty wide-ranging group, and based because it was as wide-ranging as it was, we very often had some disagreements and needed aspirin after the calls. But we have reached consensus to focus on the gas period of no collection where efficiency is zero. And next. Okay, then we get to the first order decay constants, and I'll try and speed up here a little bit because Brenda has to talk about this. EPA has a single K value for all of MSW. There was recently a meeting where people that were responsible for the EPA warm model had called in a range of scientists to talk about whether this was appropriate and whether a lot of assumptions on the organics component of the warm model were appropriate. And one of the things that was brought out was that it might be time for individual K values. Now, IPCC already has individual K values, and what they do is they vary it by the climate of where the landfill is located. However, as we talked about earlier, our sanitary landfills make their own weather. And so here, if you use the IPCC default, you're going to go for that hot tropical landfill with pretty high moisture because that's what it's like in a sanitary cell. And their K value for that is 0.231. Within our group, there was a lot of pressure to go with a higher K value. and we were talking about things like 1 to 1.4, which make degradation of food waste within about a year after deposition into a cell. And here, this lovely picture is my own home food waste bin. After a week, you can see that a pretty high amount of decomposition has already taken place, and I'm living in Seattle, and this was not taken in the summertime. So food waste is something that will degrade fairly quickly. I think our consensus here as a group was to go with a more conservative IPCC value, but we're going to get a final draft of the protocol in the next few weeks. Next slide, please. And we'll be up to number 34. Okay, if you use, here's, and somebody is telling good jokes in the background here, and I can't hear them, I can just hear the laughing, so if you're going to tell a good joke, you should tell it louder. Anyway, if you use these factors, this is the kind of decay, this is like a 0.8, it's in between the two, and you can see the rate of methane generation over a four-year period, and you can see that most, this is for food waste, which is going to be your most quickly degrading material, with biosolids next and yard waste after that. You can see that most of the gas comes out fairly quickly on these materials. And next.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Brenda Smith, and I'm going to cover the topic of anaerobic digestion, which I will refer to as AD throughout my presentation. AD is a biological process typically employed in many wastewater treatment facilities, but it also is the principal process occurring in landfills, as Sally just mentioned. Large animal farms use AD primarily for manure lagoons with capture of methane for energy production. Internationally, AD has been used for decades primarily in rural areas for the production of biogas for use as cooking and lighting fuel. And many household-scale digesters are employed in rural China and India. More recently, Europe has developed large-scale centralized systems for municipal solid waste treatment with electricity generation as a co-product. Some of the points I will be covering on AD include a discussion of the benefits, the different types of technologies, and policy issues. Then I'll go over the facilities in California and the projects and activities that we are undertaking here at the Waste Board. And finally, I will link AD to climate change protocols and carbon offsets, and then kick this presentation back to Sally for this final wrap-up. Okay, now we're on slide 36. All degradation of organic material occurs in nature principally through the action of aerobic microorganisms. Ultimately, complete oxidation of the carbonaceous organic material results in the production of carbon dioxide and water. Anaerobic microorganisms degrade the organic matter in the absence of oxygen, with ultimate products being CO2 and methane, although lignin and lignin-encased biomass degrade very slowly. Therefore, woody waste is not a good feedstock for AD. Anaerobic microorganisms occur naturally in low oxygen niches such as marshes, sediments, wetlands, and in the digestive tract of ruminant animals and certain species of insects, and also in landfills. Four biological chemical stages of anaerobic digestion are hydrolysis, acidogenesis, acetogenesis, and finally methanogenesis. And the first step, hydrolysis, produces sugars and amino acids that are then converted to organic acids, which are converted to acetic acids. And finally, within methanogenic bacteria, those are converted to methane and CO2. There's a need to carefully control the digestion temperature, pH, and the loading rates for successful reactions and breakdown of organic materials. In most AD processes, organic materials are the input, and biogas, and digester effluent, and digestate are the outputs. The biogas can be used to produce energy in the form of methane and hydrogen, which in turn can be converted into liquefied natural gas and compressed natural gas or electricity. These energy sources can be used as fuel in the agricultural sector, and I'm trying to point, hopefully you can see the pointer on the slide, the digestate or solid residue from AD can be used additionally as a feedstock to produce compost, which then can be applied as a soil amendment or fertilizer on farmland over here. And then to close the loop, the egg waste or biomass can be the feedstock source for the AD facility. Anaerobic digestion, by definition, involves using an enclosed covered system for accelerating decomposition of organic materials for the dual purposes of biogas production and waste volume reduction. Because the system is closed and emissions are captured to create various energy products, the use of AD technology by default creates a net decrease in GHG emissions, primarily by reducing the amount of methane produced and released in conventional landfills, if that's the baseline management option. AD technology creates an additional GHG benefit if the organic residual or the digestate is used as a feedstock for composting and then used as a soil amendment and fertilizer. In addition, most closed systems also obviate other potential environmental problems, including leachate, groundwater contamination, nutrient loading and runoff, vector and odor problems, volatile organic compounds, and other issues. Okay, we're on slide 39 now. Different types of AD systems exist that can vary widely depending on siting requirements, input and output products, and end uses. However, the concept of anaerobic technology is the same and mimics what occurs in nature. There are three different natural temperature regimes for anaerobic bacteria, psychrophilic, mesophilic, and thermophilic. Psychrophilic is a bacteria that thrives in cold conditions around 40 to 68 degrees Fahrenheit. Mesophilic is a moderate temperature between about 77 and 104 degrees Fahrenheit, and thermophilic is relatively high from 113 to 176 degrees Fahrenheit. Typically, AD processes use either a mesophilic or a thermophilic process. AD processes are also distinguished by the processing equipment design. Bioreactors have various stages of processing that makes them unique, and we'll talk about some of the various designs in the next slide. And of course, the feedstock will dictate the bioreactor design depending on whether it's predominantly liquid as in wastewater or solid as in solid waste. Some examples of AD technologies that are used in wastewater treatment plants are listed on this slide. Covered lagoons are also used for dairies. Mixed digester and part flow digesters are used for wastewater treatment. The UASB, or the Upflow Anaerobic Sludge Blanket Reactor, is one that some of you may have heard of. AeroBio, they use this technology, and the Upflow provides for some of the mixing there. And anaerobic digester sequencing batch reactor is also used by food processors. Okay. These are additional types of AD technologies that use solid waste as inputs to create biogas. For the most part, they're company names such as Dranco, Valorga, BTA, CompoGas. And, for example, Dranco and Valorga are single-stage processes. BTA is a two-vessel process. And the APS digester, the anaerobic-phased solids digester, is the UC Davis process, and the Waste Board actually has a project featuring that. I'll talk about it a little bit later. This shows an example of biogas production curves at dairy AD facilities, and these are in six different states, as indicated by the legend. The left axis is the milliliter of biogas per gram of volatile solids per day. We have music. Sorry about that. I don't know where that's.
Sorry, we'll get that muted for you.
Thank you. The left axis corresponds to the curves that have a peak on the left side of the chart and taper off at the 20-day mark when the digestion process is completed. And on the right axis is
is milliliters of biogas per gram of volatile solids. This is a cumulative yield over the entire digestion cycle and corresponds to the curves that reach the max on the right-hand side of the chart. Notice that most of the gas is produced within the first 7 to 10 days. And then also notice how consistent the curves are between 6 different facilities in 6 different states. I'm going to try and sing the next slide for all of you. Let's see how that works. Okay, now that I'm warmed up, this slide talks about a perspective on who will be impacted if we expand AD. Landfill operators would be impacted. More diversion of organic materials would reduce disposal volumes and potential gross tipping fees. Incentives to encourage more diversion of organic materials to AD, for instance, would have to include an increase in landfill tipping fees. As a result, although operators might experience a net decline in fees from reduced volume, they might make up some of these losses through an increase in tip fee per unit of disposal. Composters. Increased AD activity could potentially mean less feedstocks for composters. Diminished feedstocks for composters could lead to price increases since higher input costs would likely be passed on to end users. One way to mitigate for competition among feedstocks between the two industries is to actively seek post-MRF, or material recovery facility, organic waste for AD, feedstocks that would likely be too contaminated for composting. Biosolids processors, public-owned wastewater treatment plants. Increased AD use at POTWs would reduce energy costs by using on-site produced methane to power plants. In addition, digesters could mitigate some of the problems POTWs are experiencing and finding markets for biosolids since many California jurisdictions have implemented or are considering land use bans for Class B biosolids. Agriculture and livestock operators. AD would provide an on-site disposal solution that could produce power and reduce numerous externalities, including nitrate loading, VOC and methane emissions, groundwater leaching, odor and vector issues, and such concerns like that. MRFs and processors, as mentioned above, the demand for post-MRF organic residuals may increase, so MRFs may need to expand capacity and separate organic fractions from other recyclables. And then any institutions that regularly dispose of organic materials, such as restaurants, schools, or prisons, may actually realize a net cost savings from foregoing extensive landfill tipping fees. Additionally, energy production profits from ADs could serve to further subsidize diversion programs, depending on how incentive programs are structured or implemented. Let's talk about AD in California. Despite advances in organic waste diversion, AD of MSW ventures have not yet materialized in California. Prior to 2002, there were fewer than 5 dairy digesters. 10 digesters have been built in California dairies since 2002 as part of the California Energy Commission's Dairy Power Production Program, and an additional 9 were funded in 2006. And at least 5 California food processors have AD facilities for treating wastewater. Capital and operating costs are higher for AD than for composting or landfilling. The low tipping fees in California and relatively low energy prices compared to those in Europe make it difficult for AD and other conversion technologies to be cost competitive. However, recent run-up of the domestic energy prices, as we all know, is changing those economics. Most of the AD facilities in California are utilized by the sludge at wastewater treatment plants. There are approximately 137 wastewater treatment plants using this technology, and they have an estimated excess capacity of approximately 15% to 30%. A few of these facilities supplement their operations with other types of organic waste. The UC Davis Biogas Energy Demonstration Plant, which is a waste board project, is the only standalone facility constructed for acceptance of only organic waste. And I've also featured 3 examples here in this slide. One is the Inland Empire Utilities Agency, which is located in San Bernardino, and uses AD as the wastewater treatment plant for the sludge. But it also supplements its feedstock with approximately 300 tons of dairy manure and 90 tons of food waste each day. A wastewater pretreatment facility in Fresno was designed for use in the processing and cleaning of figs. The Valley Fig Growers processes approximately 8,500 tons of figs and raisins annually, which generate about 40,000 gallons of effluent waste every day. And the East Bay Municipal Utility District's main wastewater treatment plant could digest sludge and food waste. A recent study completed in March of this year determined that 100 tons of food waste per day provides sufficient power for an estimated 800 to 1,400 homes for 1 year. So how can we increase the implementation of AD in California? Regulatory changes, for one. In order for AD of municipal solid waste to become a more viable option in California, regulatory agencies need a streamlined permitting process specific to AD of MSW. Since there are solid and liquid waste and energy issues, AD could require different permits in different situations or even multiple permits. Energy market penetration. AD can typically produce much more electricity than the AD facility needs. In order to be financially viable, AD operators need access to electricity markets and reasonable prices. California has had difficulty encouraging grid operators to upgrade the grid to allow renewable energy producers to connect. And in many cases, the prices offered are too low to make the project financially feasible. Also, federal tax credits for renewable electricity are being phased out. Providing financial incentives is probably the most effective method of encouraging the development of AD. Tipping fees. AD of the organic fraction of municipal solid waste should be supported through tipping price fee structures to make AD cost competitive. And we've already talked about the low landfill tipping fees in California. Carbon credits. Digesters also reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A mature market for carbon could result in carbon credits for AD systems, making AD more cost competitive than other organic waste material options such as landfilling. And finally, waste management programs. State programs such as the California Energy Commission's Dairy Power Production Program that we talked about just a little bit ago have been very successful at promoting AD in the agricultural sector in California. Similar technical and price support programs could be used to help establish AD for MSW as a viable alternative to current organic waste disposal methods. I'm having trouble getting the next slide up. There we go. This slide features some of the projects and activities that the Waste Board is working on related to AD. For a moment, I thought it was a blank slate, so I'm relieved to see that we have some projects. In the research, development, and demonstration area, we have a couple of projects. One is the UC Davis Anaerobic Digester Pilot Project. It's a $125,000 contract, and this one is conducting trials with post-MRF residuals. We have a draft document which should be published imminently and be posted on our website, and it's titled Current AD Technologies Used for Treatment of Municipal Organic Solid Waste. And this publication looks at all the different AD technologies and evaluates them for MSW. And again, that should be posted shortly. And then we're also on this project currently waiting for test results from post-MRF trials that we anticipate in August. So they're coming up. The project has a processing capacity of around 5 to 8 tons per day. Another project that we have is the Yolo County Landfill Bioreactor project, which is actually the in situ anaerobic digestion cell within the Yolo Landfill. It's a $200,000 contract where 200 tons of source-separated organics were placed in the cell in an anaerobic composting environment a year ago in June 2007. It's under an accelerated biogas production, and it's under it's under anaerobic conditions now, but they'll switch over to aerobic conditions this month. And then excavation of the cell is planned for August 2008, where they will finish composting and quality testing of the material. And other activities include regulatory guidance documents. The Waste Board has it's listed here in the slide as an AD guidance document, but it's actually a conversion technology guidance document, of which anaerobic digestion is one of those technologies being featured there. And it's also available on our website. It was developed December of last year. And then we are involved in the participation of a multi-agency effort. There's a guidance document being produced by CalEPA, and it brings to the table many of the regulatory agencies, including the Waste Board, the Water Board, DTSC, the ARB, and others. And this multi-agency guidance document is looking at permitting issues for AD. Joy Luther, I believe, is our Waste Board contact from compliance on that multi-agency team. And last, we are also involved in a lot of planning and outreach activities. We've been a member of the California Biomass Collaborative for 4 years now, and this collaborative works to enhance the sustainable management and development of biomass in California for the production of renewable energy, biofuels, and products. And then I've listed a few websites there that you might find of interest in for more information. My computer's a little slow, so I'm waiting for my slide to come up. There we go. This slide just summarizes the greenhouse gas emission reductions associated with AD, and those result in primarily three emission reductions. Methane emissions are reduced by diverting organic materials from landfills to digesters, which are fully enclosed, closed-loop systems. Energy is produced through methane and hydrogen production, which offsets traditional fossil fuel production and use, and which further reduces GHG emissions. And finally, the use of the digestate to produce compost results in additional GHG emission reductions through beneficial offsets there. Again, I'm waiting on the slide to come up. I don't even have any fun graphics in these, so sorry. Okay, we're now on slide 48, and this slide is featuring the climate exchanges. The Chicago Climate Exchange is North America's carbon trading system to reduce emissions of GHGs with offset projects worldwide. The CCX members commit to meet annual GHG emission reduction targets, a minimum of 1% per year, for a total reduction of 4% below their baseline for phase 1, and then 6% below baseline by 2010 for phase 2. Those who reduce their below their targets have surplus allowances to sell or bank. Those who emit above their targets comply by purchasing CCX carbon financial instruments, or CFI contracts, the commodity that's traded on the CCX. Each CFI represents 100 metric tons of CO2 equivalent. And CCX has developed standardized rules for issuing CFI contracts for project types, including agricultural methane, landfill methane, agricultural soil carbon, renewable energy, and there are others as well. The California Climate Action Registry, CCAR, was established by the California State Legislature as a voluntary greenhouse gas registry that promulgates GHG reporting standards and tools for organizations to measure, report, verify, and reduce their GHG emissions in California and also in the United States. The state of California has worked closely with CCAR to develop its reporting and verification guidance, including both a general reporting protocol, a verification protocol, and also industry-specific reporting protocols based on the principles of relevance, completeness, consistency, accuracy, and transparency. Their industry-specific protocols include forest protocols, power utility protocols, net protocols, and their project-specific protocols include forest, landfills, and livestock. And their protocols that are in progress include local government operations and others. And as under these exchanges, there are developments of protocols with respect to AD. The CCS Agricultural Methane Gas Project Guidelines is a baseline calculation that requires the project baseline manure management practice to be defined as liquid or slurry deep pit or anaerobic lagoon. And then exchange methane offsets will be issued to owners of GHG emission reductions achieved by agricultural methane collection and combustion systems placed into operation on or after January 1, 1999. And one of the protocols we talked about for CCAR was the livestock project reporting protocol and livestock project verification protocol, and it's associated with installing a manure biogas control system for livestock operations such as dairy cattle and swine farms. And this protocol is available for public use, and it's applicable in California and nationwide, as I mentioned. Project developers that install manure biogas capture and combustion technologies will use this protocol to register GHG reductions with the registry. These protocols were adopted in June of 2007. However, they're currently under comment. They've been updated, and the CCAR is accepting comments on this protocol up until July 25th, and you can send that to the registry. And I just wanted to feature a project in California that is selling carbon offsets, and that's Joseph Farms, and they operate a methane digester system that generates power for operations from their own waste. The digester is a 7-acre anaerobic covered lagoon which generates biogas. The gas is scrubbed and then piped to two power generators. One is a 300 kilowatt hour and the other one is 400. The power generated by these two large generators is used to provide electricity for Joseph Farms' cheese plant. And the heat captured from the generators and exhaust is used to heat water for the cheese plant usage, offsetting some of the need for propane to heat boilers. As much as 80% of the power required to operate the cheese plant is supplied by this system. And now, I will kick this back to Sally for the wrap-up.
Thanks, Brenda. Sally, the floor is yours.
Okay, and I will try and not linger over slides, but will also appreciate your manning the controls here. Okay, when you have anaerobic decomposition in a digester, you get stuff at the end. That stuff will get dewatered, and it'll end up still being primarily water, and that is material that's pretty high in nutrients and can be composted. So whether you take the material out of the landfill and go directly to composting, or if you take it to anaerobic digestion, controlled anaerobic digestion, you can still at the end have a material that gets composted. And composting is an aerobic process. So we're up to that part of the presentation. Here's a compost facility and a scarab doing a turn right here in number 52. If we could go to the next. Okay. There are different parts of a composting process, and a lot of people have assumed that composting in and of itself is makes such wonderful stuff that everybody knows is so great that compost has to be a fabulous thing for greenhouse gases as well. And in fact, the composting process can be a source of greenhouse gas emissions. So you have to realize that compost can have some fugitive emissions and almost always does have some fugitive emissions associated with it. If you do composting on anything other than a backyard scale, you're going to use heavy equipment. And that equipment is going to be for both transport to get stuff to the facility as well as to manage the composting process. And every time you use equipment, you use fuel, and if you use fuel, you get greenhouse gas emissions. Realize that getting stuff to the landfill also requires some fuel, but what we decided in the protocol was to discount transport most cases, because equivalent transport to compost site versus transport to a landfill site. However, when you use use equipment at the compost facility, if we go to the next slide, which is number 54, you can start quantifying how much fuel you use to take care of a pile. Now, we have two studies that we're looking at here for values. One was done by the Recycled Organics Unit at University of New South Wales in Australia, other done by EPA. Both looked at windrow facilities, and they both came up with pretty much the same answer. 5 to 6 kilograms of fuel for a windrow facility per wet ton of material, and that comes to about 20 kilograms of CO2. So not a whole bunch here in the grand scheme of things, but nevertheless an emission. And then if you go to the next. Okay. In our protocol, we came up with the fault factors. We went beyond the windrow. We went to the aerated static pile. We went to mechanical systems. There's a range of different compost systems, windrow being the most common, and also the least energy intensive. So the more energy, the fancier your system, the more energy it will use. And here are some estimates. A lot of cases, you'll use electricity, and you'll have to do the site-specific conversion where your compost facility is located, where the electricity comes from to get a conversion of the greenhouse gas equivalent. So what we did in the protocol was do average electricity uses for different kinds of systems. And we can go to the next. I should add, if your composting material that has been diverted as from a landfill as one of the highly putrescible materials, all these emissions that I'm going to go over here from the composting process are going to be minimal in comparison to the methane avoidance emissions that you get for diversion. They will count, but they will be minimal. Okay? Composting process itself. Now, you're doing this in an aerobic fashion because that's the way the waste decomposes and turns into compost most efficiently. However, like in a landfill, in a compost pile, there'll be pockets that may be anaerobic. Realize people can be very concerned about fugitive emissions of greenhouse gases during composting, but just think of the magnitude change. If you're taking stuff from a pile in a landfill where it was made to be anaerobic, an attempt was made to make this an anaerobic site for decomposition versus a compost pile where it's supposed to be as aerobic as possible to reduce odors and accelerate formation of compost, you can realize that however much is emitted from a compost pile, it's going to be much smaller than what's emitted from an anaerobic facility. Okay. However, stuff does come out of the pile, and let's get some information on that. You guys can read the slide so I don't have to go through that. But you can also manage your compost facility to minimize formation of fugitive greenhouse gases. And next slide. Okay, I love this because this is an illustration. This is from a paper from 2001 by Howe, and you see this is the depth of a pile, and you see where you find the methane and where you find the nitrous oxide, and also when. So how deep it is at the very bottom of the pile is where you're finding your methane. The darker color, my computer just went on sleep, so I just had to wake it up here. Anyway, when you get to the bottom of the pile, that's where you're going to be most likely to find methane, most likely to find anaerobic conditions. And in fact, the top portion of the pile is going to be your more aerated portion of your pile, and there's some evidence that suggests that your top portion of your pile will oxidize any methane that tries to migrate through the pile. Nitrous oxide, not as clear. Also notice that it's in much smaller units, so don't get its parts per billion here rather than percentage, so it's a huge difference in units, so don't get upset by the dark colors, but realize it's in the middle of the pile, the portion that's going to be low in oxygen but not necessarily absolutely no oxygen. And if we go to the next slide. What you realize with these is the main thing here is air. if you have sufficient air to maintain the pile in the vast majority of its parts and sections as an aerobic compost pile, the chances of getting fugitive emissions are going to decrease enormously. So as the aeration status of the pile goes up, your greenhouse gas potential goes down. Now, one thing that's a very easy way to say, okay, if you want to qualify for credits here, what kind of monitoring do you have to do? And this has already been done in California. If you require that compost facilities meet the EPA time and temperature requirements for pathogen destruction, which is routinely required for all biosolids compost facilities, in many states required for food composting facilities, in California required for composting facilities, that's 55 degrees centigrade, 3 days for each of 5 turns in a windrow pile, those are the time and temperature regs, you're going to maintain aerobic conditions that will not only reduce your methane to almost nothing, it will also prevent odors from forming, it'll give you pathogen-free material, so it's a win-win all around, and that's what the group has decided as an easy adoption measure, as one thing to require. Now, if we go to the next. Another thing, and this is what you see in the recycled organics unit, and this makes a whole lot of sense if you worked on a compost facility. If you have to add water to the pile to make sure it's wet enough for the microbes to decompose, there's a very good chance that the site is so dry that you really don't have to worry about methane release. So, in cases, what we specify in the protocol, in cases that supplemental water is added to maintain sufficient moisture, you can negate the potential or discount the potential for methane and nitrous oxide to be released. And I got to go really fast here. Okay, next. Okay, if you have a biofilter odor control system, this will likely oxidize the methane. Here's a nice smelly fish. You can imagine what that's like when it rots. So another case, these are controls you can have in place. And these are all going to be specified in the protocol. A lot of them are straightforward, good practices for composting. So next. Okay, C to N ratio of the material. This is not in the protocol, but this is a really nice tool. If you have too much nitrogen, you're going to have a higher chance for nitrous oxide formation. This is from a study with biosolids only added to soil at a very high rate. As the C to N ratio increases, that nitrous oxide production goes way down. The same will be true in a compost pile. So don't try and compost pure manure. Don't try and compost pure biosolids. And next. Moisture content. Here's a study, and it shows two different C to N ratios as well as two different dry matter concentrations. And once you reduce that moisture content and you increase that C to N ratio a little bit, you get an elimination of methane and nitrous oxide avoidance. So we do have a moisture content clause in the CCX protocol. And there it is, in the light blue on the bottom. And again, good operating practice. And next one. Okay. So we, in the protocol, we give that you have to do time and temperature for EPA. You have to have, there are certain cases, if you have certain management practices in place, you can discount any fugitive emissions. And if none of those apply, we have default values to give you some deductions from your credit for fugitive release of methane and fugitive release of nitrogen. These both are in line with the IPCC recommended value. And again, if you take a material out of the landfill that we've identified in this protocol, these are going to be minimal in comparison to the credits you would get for methane avoidance. And next. Okay, use of compost. Now, the EPA warm model, one of the reasons they had people in to talk about this was that there were minimal credits, greenhouse gas credits, the way they modeled things for the use of compost. What they modeled was using compost on field corn at relatively low application rates, and they only considered carbon sequestration potential. The Recycled Organics Unit in New South Wales did a much more sophisticated modeling using compost as mulch on grapes or cotton directly incorporated into the soil, and they considered a much wider range of potential benefits. Realize these potential benefits, though they can be very significant, and they're being evaluated in the LCA on organics that the Waste Management Board is looking at, and I'll talk about that in just a second, are going to be benefits that don't have great greenhouse gas implications, but have a lot of benefits for soil sustainability, agricultural sustainability. And in fact, if you go to the next slide and look at the percent difference that the Recycled Organics Unit got, this is for wine grapes in a vineyard, water savings of about 10 to 15%, which comes out to 1 million liters of water per hectare. That's a whole lot of showers. Big time fertilizer savings, close to 50% for nitrogen and phosphorus. Just about elimination of herbicide use, elimination of erosion, and an observed big yield increase. And next. This is a picture slide. You get to see a picture. With the California Waste Management Board study, I'm doing a piece of this with Matt Cotton, and in fact, he and I just went on a compost road trip. Like, it was it Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis on the road to, anyway, it was Sally Brown and Matt Cotton, and we weren't nearly as funny as the other movies. What we did was we sampled a range of farms from the Palm Springs area up north to the Monterey area, using composted sites versus non-composted sites. And here I am sampling in an almond orchard, and you can see me getting the soil cores, and these are currently being analyzed in a lab in California. If you go to the next. We sampled a range of crops that can be divided into two big categories: orchard row crops, where compost was applied right under the tree or the vine, and then row crops, where the stuff was applied to the field as a whole, in both tilled and no-till systems. And what we found was a lot of the growers that are using a lot of compost are organic growers, and they're getting a vast majority of their fertilizers from the compost, and they're using it for many things. Fruit quality is one of the biggest reasons that people are using compost. You should also know that we're doing a similar thing in Washington State, and there are some of the cooperators. And the next. Where's the rest of the picture? Come on, guys. Here's our soil per site. You can see what we're doing. We're looking at water infiltration rate. You can see that length of pipe. That's going to be water holding capacity. That blue T there is bulk density. And then we also took individual cores and composited them for soil chemical analysis. So we're looking at a pretty broad range here. Soil microbial biological function is another thing that we're looking at. And the next. Here is 10 years of compost, and you can see, and we saw this again and again, you do get that organic matter accumulation. You can see that black top portion of the soil there. That's from the compost addition. How much is being retained in the soil? How much increase in C do we get? This is one of the things we'll be measuring. And next. Okay, this poor guy, Frank, Soil Control Labs, he has had his hands full. This is the all of the samples that we collected, and what I will do is we got one set, and we started to get results from this, and that's on the next slide. Bulk density. This is a measure of how heavy a soil is, and you want your soil to be light and fluffy. If any of you have gardened, you know that a heavy soil is not good for getting water into it. It's not good for plants to get their roots into it. So you want about bulk density to be lower. And in fact, at a farm in Indio, California, organic lemons and grapes, what we see is about an 80% reduction in bulk density with compost use. So this is the first inkling of results, and this bulk density we saw pretty consistently through all the orchard soils that we sampled. I haven't done the stats on that, but so far, the first results looking very nice. And the next slide, please. Okay. Talking to growers, I already said we heard again and again, growers that grow for Sunkist, growers that grow avocados, growers that grow vine, grapes, quality. Fruit quality is a way that they compete, not just yield. And what they see with the compost is a big increase in produce quality. Fertilizer, erosion control, water savings. One of the guys that we sampled, he wasn't an organic grower. He was a conventional grower. However, he'd been using compost religiously. At one point, he stopped for 2 years, and he said when he stopped using the compost, the vines just crashed. They went right back on. He was religious enough about this that when he couldn't buy compost early on, he was making his own. Now he happily is buying from a number of sources. He's in the Central Valley. And next. Okay, so when you're talking about this process, right now the credits for the compost are only for methane avoidance for landfill diversion, and this is for limited feedstocks, food scraps, biosolids, and yard material, yard waste materials. There are process emissions. These are minimal, and there are factors in the protocol to control these, and there are benefits. The benefits are not quantified in the protocol. They're the benefits in terms of greenhouse gases are small in comparison to methane avoidance. We're working both in California and in Washington to start quantifying the benefits, and we are not the only ones doing this. And that's it.
Great. Well, now we have a couple minutes set aside for questions for both Sally and Brenda. Thank you both for those presentations. We do have one more speaker today who has an exciting presentation for us, Gary Liss. So we'll just take a couple minutes of presentations and questions, and we'll move on to Gary. So let's see. We have a lot of great questions here. And if you wrote in a question and we don't get to answer it today, we'll send you an email with the answer. This is for Brenda. Is anaerobic digestion being evaluated as part of the Integrated Waste Management Board's organic life cycle analysis? And if so, can you speak about that for a minute?
Yes, it is. And actually, it's a good question for both me and Sally, because Sally is on our life cycle analysis of organics project team. And it is one of the organics management alternatives that's being considered. The project looks at others as well, composting. The baseline consideration is landfilling. So hopefully that answers the question, and unless Sally has something else to offer.
I know that we're the people on the project are trying to gather information on excess digester capacity in wastewater treatment plants. They've been in touch with the people in East Bay about their project, and we're trying to include this as a very viable option.
Okay, great. Now we have a question about PLA, which I think is polylactic acid. PLA degrades at higher temperatures. Will it degrade in the warm environment of the landfill and thus produce methane?
I have no idea. I mean,
okay.
That's an easy answer.
Okay.
Yes, you might know.
And we can look into that too, and if someone else who's speaking today knows, we can send an email. So, Sally, I think this one is directed for you. Even if methane collection in the landfill is zero before a gas collection system is put in place, won't there still be some methane oxidation in the cover materials, which could be...
Yeah, I can answer. In fact, that's taken into account in the equation, and it's we use the default value of the 10% oxidation rate, which is what IPCC and EPA also uses. And even though it may be higher, being that this is the value given by EPA and IPCC, it's very easy to accept and very hard to go against at this point in time.
Okay. Another landfill question here, Matt. How much do landfill tipping fees need to increase for anaerobic digestion to be economically competitive?
I'll take a stab at that for California. I haven't looked at the average landfill tipping fee in California, but they vary depending on what region you're in, and I would guess that the average might be around $40 or $45 per ton. And again, depending on the anaerobic digestion facility, what types of feedstocks, where it's located, all that, I'm thinking it would be in the range of $60 to $70 per ton. So that's kind of your cost difference there.
Okay. $60 to $70 per ton, you said, I'm sorry.
Can I add one thing there? What you see in Europe is that tipping fees have gone to over $200 a ton, and then you also see in some countries a prorated purchasing price for energy from anaerobic digesters. So two things working in tandem, a higher tipping fee as well as higher energy paid to energy coming from anaerobic digestion, which decreases over time. So it's a two-pronged approach to making anaerobic digestion cost-effective.
Okay. Why is sea sequestration considered for composting but not for landfills?
Actually, in the protocol for the CCX, it's not considered in composting. The EPA warm model does have a minimal component of carbon sequestration. The recycled organics unit does. The material that we're talking about for this protocol, however, is very rapidly putrescible and is not the material that would be sequestered in a landfill. So for the subsection of MSW we're talking about, that's really not a pertinent question.
Okay. Is there any work being done to develop a protocol for the avoided greenhouse gas emissions from use of digestate as compost?
There's talk about a protocol for alternative fertilizer sources, so using different sources and in different nitrogen management practices. There's also, I have a grad student working on a protocol for carbon accumulation in soils restored with organic amendments. There's an existing protocol for no-till farming, and there's research coming out in a number of different areas that show that if you use organic amendments in combination with no-till, you get very significant increases in carbon accumulation. Realize this is a very new process, and so I would imagine these things will come with time.
Okay. Let's try one more question before we move on to the final presentation, and I think this is directed to Brenda. Brenda, you said composters could be denied some feedstock directed to anaerobic digestion, but wouldn't composters benefit from using the stabilized solid residues from AD?
Yes, absolutely. That would be an additional feedstock to composters typically coming. That's the digestate coming out of an anaerobic digestion facility. It's not finished. It needs to be composted, so that would be directed to composters. That's correct.
Okay. Great. Well, we might have some time for additional questions at the end of all of the presentations, but now let's move on to our final presentation, Gary Liss.
Thank you. My goal is to talk about how zero waste fits in with all the topics that we've been talking about in terms of climate change, and particularly going to look at how zero waste is a key tool to accomplish the goals. I'm having a problem with my computer now, too. So, Tommy, if you could march the slides along like you did for Sally, I'd appreciate it.
Will do.
So, next slide. One of the things we first want to take a look at is what do we mean by zero waste? We go to the basic phrase of reduce, reuse, recycle, and say that if in fact we did reduce, reuse, and recycle, we'd be very close to achieving zero waste. The focus of the past year, decade or two has been on recycling, and we need to focus first on reducing and reusing waste and discarded materials, and then recycling or composting the rest. Next slide, please. The definition of zero waste is a more formal look at what do we mean by zero waste. And there's two key phrases there. One, that all discarded materials are resources for others to use. And secondly, that we don't want to burn or bury those resources. Next slide. Through the process today, we've heard a lot about the connections between wasting and climate change. So I won't go into a lot of these details, although on my slide I do use the conventional methane being 21 times more potent than CO2. I concur with Sally Brown and the StopTrashingTheClimate.org report that 72 times is the key number, the multiplier that we need to keep in mind, because it is in the next 20 years where we're approaching the tipping point when it comes to climate change, and we need to be addressing that in these analyses. When the Recyclers Global Warming Council of the California Resource Recovery Association used the EPA WARM model and looked at all the materials currently being discarded in California and seeing what would happen if all those were recycled or composted, they found it was the equivalent of taking all cars off the road in terms of greenhouse gases. When you think in those terms, it underscores why this is so important. The other thing that we'd like to emphasize is the Wasteburg, which talks about for every ton in front of us, there's 71 tons produced upstream from mining, manufacturing, and distribution of products. And for those looking for a citation on that, it's page 13 of the Wasting and Recycling in the U.S. report that can be found at the ILSR.org website. And so when you look at that 71-ton multiplier for the Wasteburg, it really underscores why we can't recycle our way out of this problem. We need to actually stop waste from being created in the first place, and we need to reuse products for their original form and function as long as possible so we don't have to keep mining, manufacturing, and distributing new products. And that's the importance of that 71. If you combine the 71 tons upstream with the 72 times potency, you start seeing why wasting and climate change and zero waste policies are so critical to moving forward. People not as familiar with zero waste, I also want to underscore that zero waste is really an umbrella term for a wide variety of policies, programs, and facilities that can work to reduce our waste, reuse it, and recycle and compost. And one of the things that zero waste policies work to do is to change the system and to change the economics. If you look at the tipping fees we just heard about in Europe from Sally Brown of $200 a ton, in many of the nations there, the tipping fees have included in them a $20 to $40 per ton surcharge, a landfill surcharge, which was adopted by the individual countries in order to fund new reduce, reuse, and recycling programs and to phase organics out of the landfill. The European Union adopted a landfill directive to phase organics out of landfill by the next decade, the next decade, I believe 2016. And in this country, there's a new campaign that the Grassroots Recycling Network and BioCycle has launched to keep compostable organics out of landfills as well, just like the European model, to get those organics into more controlled systems to recover the benefit, like we've been hearing about earlier in the presentation, in both composting systems and anaerobic digestion biological systems. Next slide, please. On climate action plans, one of the things I want to underscore is this is probably one of the biggest connections now between zero waste and climate change. many progressive communities around the country and around the world are trying to move forward faster than their federal government to address climate change because they're so concerned about it, and particularly since Inconvenient Truth in the last 2 years, there's been a huge upswing in interest by every elected official to be the greenest official, to have their community be the greenest community, and to respond to that, there are programs that have been set up which are generally referred to as Cool Cities or Cool Counties programs, and as part of them, we have a variety of things being done to move forward at the local level to address climate action issues. The first is inventories, emission inventories, where they go in and look at the sources of different types of emissions coming from the communities, and then the second step is to develop climate action plans to move forward with programs to address those inventories. Actually, I got my computer back on. If you could give me control back, Tommy, I should be able to take it from here. ICLEI is one of the key groups that is working on this, originally called the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. It now goes by Local Governments for Sustainability. And the ICLEI is working with over 800 cities worldwide, including all the communities that are working with the U.S. Conference of Mayors on their climate protection plans, with the Sierra Club as well, to provide support to them to develop these inventories and climate action plans. One of the things we like to highlight, though, in terms of zero waste, of all the different Cool City programs that are out there, there's only one, the Urban Environmental Accords, developed by the United Nations in 2005, that includes zero waste by 2040. And in fact, other Cool Cities programs like that of the U.S. Conference of Mayors include landfill gas recovery and burning waste as ways to address climate change, which is a contradiction in terms from those in the zero waste arena. So we urge anyone working on climate action plans to look at the Urban Environmental Accords and pursue their provisions for zero waste by 2040 as a key component of any local climate action plans. Communities all over the world have embraced zero waste, particularly in recent years. We see a huge increase in that. New Zealand has led the way with over 70% of New Zealand cities having adopted it. Major cities, small cities around the world have adopted this. Buenos Aires, Toronto, major cities outside the U.S. In the U.S., we have, again, large and small cities. In California, over 20 cities have adopted zero waste as a goal and are planning for that. In the Bay Area, many of these cities are working together through the Bay Area Zero Waste Communities Group to help pool their resources to develop initiatives. Many of the cities have developed zero waste plans already, and others are developing them as we speak, such as Los Angeles and Austin, Texas, are developing plans right now. When you look at the issue of zero waste, is it attainable? We talk about that nature is the model, that in nature there are no landfills or incinerators, that everything in nature is a resource or a home for something else. And from nature, we have 3.5 billion years of experience in how nature figures out how to accomplish that, and that we need to look at how nature does that In America, particularly, we think in terms of recycling, in terms of mostly crushing and grinding things, and what we need to do is broaden our thinking to use biology and things like the anaerobic digestion and composting systems we heard about earlier today, but also all sorts of chemistry, physics, natural principles, such as those promoted by Janine Benyus and biomimicry and ZERI, the Zero Emissions Research and Initiatives. The other thing we talk about is don't get hung up on the zero. The message is zero waste, we're darn close. We're seeing that our goal is to achieve zero air, water, and land emissions, but we are defining success increasingly by diverting 90% of the discarded materials from landfills and incineration. And we're finding that businesses are leading the way to zero waste, having already achieved that type of reduction. And again, this slide highlights a wide range of businesses, many of which are documented on the grrn.org website, that, again, are large and small businesses, electronics and organics businesses. Some of them are, like in San Francisco, a number of restaurants are there because the community is a zero-waste community. They've provided services so that their businesses can participate easily, conveniently, and at lower cost than wasting. And when they have that type of a system in place, everyone can participate, and that's why there's a number of restaurants on this list, and there's lots more out there. Other companies on the list have been doing this for many years. Xerox Corporation did it because they leased out equipment and came back. It was either an asset or a liability. They chose to make it an asset. They refurbished the machines, put them out there. When they couldn't refurbish them anymore, they took the parts out, refurbished other machines, and when they couldn't get anything else out, then they would recycle the rest as part of their waste-free factory that was developed in the beginning of the 1990s. Things to note are that over 2,800 businesses in Japan have adopted zero waste as a goal, and 99% have achieved zero to landfill already. Many zero waste businesses have been highlighting their successes at the Earth Resource Foundation conferences, and there's a link here to past conference presentations where you can go to get the presentations yourselves to show to others. Why do businesses adopt zero waste is a multifaceted thing. Sometimes it's because someone asked, like in Japan, the environmental ministry asked businesses to join in with the implementation of the Kyoto Protocol, and that's why there's so many Japanese companies that have achieved that. Other things have moved businesses towards this, such as their own policies for continuous improvement, like Pillsbury, where they want to do 10% better at waste reduction each year. So there's a variety of policies that can move them. Economics, all the zero waste businesses that have been documented have saved money. They increase their efficiency. They avoid liabilities, particularly liabilities associated with landfilling. Once they recognize that every ton of waste they put in a landfill can come back and haunt them, when those landfills close down, the particularly private landfills, the landfill operators and owners can walk away from those landfills 30 years after they're closed or when there's no threat to the environment in California. And then once there's no one responsible, those landfills can open up and cause significant liability. Then CERCLA, the Superfund, kicks in, and the lawyers, they figure out how much waste was sent to a facility, and they send you a bill for your share of any leaking that's going on. So avoiding that liability is a really significant driver, particularly highlighted by Bank of America at one of our zero waste business conferences. trying to distinguish themselves as green businesses. Toyota highlights now in their ads on TV that they're not only for zero emissions, they're for zero waste, trying to distinguish themselves as the greenest of the green companies that are out there. Other companies are responding to activist pressures, and a lot of businesses are doing it because it's the right thing to do, and their company executives embrace those goals. To support those green businesses and zero-waste businesses, communities like Oakland have included in their zero-waste plan key goals, such as are indicated on this slide, to support those green businesses, to buy green goods and services from zero-waste businesses, and to recognize that for every 10,000 tons of material, if you landfill it, it only creates one job, whereas if you compost it, it creates four jobs. If you recycle 10,000 tons of material, it creates 10 jobs, and if you reuse 10,000 tons of reusables, it creates 75 to 250 jobs. And that the recycling industry is as large as the automobile industry in America, as large as the motion picture industry in California, and five times the size of the garbage industry. So this is a significant employer in America. Why waste those jobs? Why throw them away? Let's use zero-waste policies as tools to move forward. To do that, we need to get them included in the climate change plans locally and at the state and federal level. AB 32, the Global Warming Solutions Act in California, is a key tool for doing that. The Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee of EPAC, of the Air Resources Board and AB 32, came out with a report in February that highlights the importance of doing this. And the page numbers and URL to that report are listed. The EPAC report was a very independent review of these issues, basically by businesses who will be affected by AB 32. And those recommendations, stressing so much the keys between wasting and climate change, highlight the importance of moving forward with that. The AB 32 scoping plan is just being considered by the Air Resources Board, needs to incorporate those EPAC recommendations and has not done so. This is an important opportunity now to make sure that the Air Resources Board listens to their business interests, the Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee, and embraces those recommendations and includes them in the scoping plan. There are many other facets to the implementation of AB 32, a couple of which are indicated here. There are a number of climate change groups that are out there as resources to enable people to plug into these issues. One of the most recent developments is the Stop Trashing the Climate report, which highlights all the connections and details, and the URLs for these are listed. And there's a number of other resources listed as other organizations. The California Resource Recovery Association is also having their annual conference this year focused on the connections between wasting and climate change in what they call Carbonopoly, a game we can't afford to lose. And there's some great resources on this list that people can follow up and pursue together to join with the zero waste efforts. This is a great slide on what are the different components of a zero waste economy, many of which are embraced and embodied in the zero waste plans that have been adopted by different communities. Mark Gagliardi in Oakland used this particular slide when he was first talking to people about zero waste in Oakland, and just took this one page around to highlight the different facets of it when he was trying to get people to understand the basics of what he was talking about. We encourage you to do the same. So with that, I got my warning for time and am open to questions. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Gary. We have quite a few good questions coming in. And again, I just want to let people know if we don't have time to answer your question on the phone here today, we'll try to send you an email. Gary, what is the factual basis of the statement that landfills are one of the largest sources of greenhouse gases, given that the ARB inventory shows that it's 1% of the overall emissions?
I would defer to the other speakers as being more expert on that question. Does anyone else want to chime in on that? Absent anyone else chiming in, I would just say that's a often cited statistic done by detailed analysis. If you go to epa.gov, WasteWise, and click and search for climate change, there's 10 years of documentation of all sorts of reports and studies on the connections between wasting and climate change, and those substantiate those numbers.
Okay, thanks. And just one last question before we run out of time. You mentioned Oakland. Could you know of any other specific cities, including waste reduction and climate plans? For example, someone mentioned that the city of Alameda has adopted a climate action plan that includes zero waste.
Yes, San Francisco was one of the first to actually, in their climate action plan for the city about 5 or 6 years ago, include zero waste initiatives as a part of that. There they saw that those could be about 10% of the total plan's successes if they implemented their recycling and composting initiatives, and they were not able to quantify source reduction initiatives as part of that. In the city of Alameda, all the communities in Alameda County have been working with funding from StopWaste.org, the local waste management, recycling, and social reduction authority there to develop community climate action plans with assistance from ICLEI. And the city of Alameda, I'm glad you mentioned, because that plan showed that of all the things that they could do, including owning their own municipal utility, that the largest thing that they could do most quickly to address climate change was reduce, reuse, and recycle. And those initiatives are really highlighting that key message that whether you call it zero waste or you just focus on maximizing, reducing, using, and recycling and EPR policies to take back products, whatever you call it, if you're pursuing those things to address the wasting connections and climate change at the local level, zero waste and those initiatives are the single fastest, most effective, cheapest way to address climate change.
Okay, great. Maybe just one last question, maybe like a one-minute answer. How is a company declared zero waste? Is there some kind of a certification?
There's certification being considered right now to be developed, but there isn't a process in place. So at this point, we urge you to follow the only peer-reviewed, internationally accepted definition of zero waste, which is the one on slide 77 from the Zero Waste International Alliance of the presentation today at zwia.org. To adopt that as the goal for any program, and then to measure yourself according to zero waste business standards adopted by Zero Waste International Alliance or the Grassroots Recycling Network. And in those standards, they set the threshold to measure their achievement as over 90% being diverted from waste from landfills and incineration. And if you're at that level, those would be appropriate to call yourself zero waste, and let us know. I work with the Grassroots Recycling Network to document companies that are considered zero waste businesses, and we'd love to hear from you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, I hate to have to end this. We still have a lot of questions, but we'll try to send you guys answers over email. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Dana Warren with EPA to wrap it up here.
Thank you very much, everyone, for participating in today's West Coast webinar on climate change, waste prevention, recovery, and disposal. Speakers, thank you very much. Your presentations were very informative and useful, and we really appreciate your contributions. I want to just give a quick overview of our next webinar, which is on August 5th from 1 to 3:30 p.m. Pacific time, and it will cover accounting systems, modeling, and economic incentives. We'll hear from Kate Krebs, formerly of the National Recycling Coalition, who will provide an introductory overview and a national perspective. We'll hear from Jess Morris of Sound Resource Management, who will cover climate change and resource management modeling tools. We'll hear from Evan Edgar of Edgar & Associates, who will cover economic incentives, climate change, and resource management. We'll hear from Lisa Skumatz of Skumatz Economic Research Associates Incorporated on reducing greenhouse gas emissions with recycling investments. And we'll hear from Joshua Stoleroff of U.S. EPA headquarters, who will cover materials management and greenhouse gas accounting. We hope you can participate. Please don't forget to give us feedback on today's session. It helps us to provide you with better information and better webinars. Tommy Jean will provide you with more information on how feedback will work. Thank you so much.
Yeah, just to wrap up, thank you so much for participating today. When you are logging off, there will be a pop-up window that asks you just about four simple questions. If you could answer those for us, we'd really appreciate it. In addition, you'll get an email that gives you a link to a more complete survey where you can type in a little bit more information to help us really figure out whether the information today was great, how you used it, and what we can do to improve these in the future. So again, the pop-up survey, you only have one chance to answer it's when you're logging off. The email survey you'll get, and that will be open for about a week for you to fill out. Thanks for your participation today, and the session is closed.